Hello and welcome to the Spying, Spies and Revelations edition of Intrigue Explained. Hi folks, with me as always is Dmitry Grozbinski, the founder and director of the marvelous trade platform Explain Trade. Dmitry, you're in Geneva as always, how are you?
I am very well. It is cold and grey here, but always warmer for your company.
That is an appalling way to start a podcast with that kind of level of insincerity just dripping from the microphone that I see. I would kill you to just say something. You know, I'm well, John, how are you?
Nope.
Helen. How are you? You're back in DC. You've been, it's a running theme now on our podcast that you're somewhere in the world that we can't keep track of. I did know that you were in South Korea for 10 days, hence me and Dmitry holding down the fort last week. You're back in DC.
That's right.
How are you?
Unsupervised, mind you. Unsupervised last week, although it was really fantastic. Gosh, what a treasure trove of WTO facts dropped by Dmitry last week. But yeah, back in DC this week, nice and sunny here, opposite of grey and cold. Dmitry, getting really warm and very happy to be back.
There you go. Excellent. All right, well, this week we're going to have a different conversation, something that neither of us, I would say, are experts on, but have kind of done a lot of thinking around, and this is spies, spying, and the revelations of recent spying kind of escapades right around the world. In our former lives as diplomats, you're kind of operating in a world where everyone asks you if you are a spy, and you try really hard not to say I'll have to kill you, but because it's a terrible joke, but inevitably end up saying that anyway. But you know, you kind of operate in the same world, right? Like you're kind of in an embassy, people are kind of reticent around you. So even though we don't have firsthand experience of that job, we can discuss what we think about it, why things are happening, what the strategy is behind all of this kind of stuff. And I think it'll be an interesting conversation if people bear in mind that we...
Novels, right? That's, I think, the extent of our knowledge.
Well, I mean, I think that's the most realistic depiction of life in an embassy that there's ever been. Slow Horses is pretty close to it as well.
Love but, Slow Horses. Yes.
I've just read a lot of Spy versus Spy comics. So I imagine that's what I'll be bringing to the conversation.
Seeing the world in monochrome. Yeah, exactly. Before that, State of the Union was last night, folks. Joe Biden got up there and delivered his, how long was it, about an hour or so? I think it was interesting and worth just kind of touching on before we get into the guts of today, because I was talking with a journalist friend of mine last night. It feels to me, I've watched a few of these kinds of things. They're always fairly tedious and, you know, performative, but it felt like foreign policy was more at the center of this one than it has been in previous years. Obviously, we've had Ukraine kind of dominate the last couple of ones, but it wasn't very contentious. This year, it felt that there was political contentiousness in the air. I don't know. Dmitry, what's your reflection on last night?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that take more. If you look at where he began, it was on foreign policy. And there is always a foreign policy component to these speeches. You know, these are Christmas tree speeches. The process is literally every stakeholder and government department fighting to get their little two sentences in on their pet priority. And of course, the president is going to talk about foreign policy. But the fact that effectively his opening gambit, his opening salvo was on the encouraging Putin to attack NATO members that spend less than 2% on defense, the fact that that was his opening way of setting the stage. Now, obviously, part of that was a performance choice. He wanted to very clearly indicate for the audience what kind of speech it was going to be. States of the Union tend to be a little bit, I wouldn't say more bipartisan, but they tend to sit higher above the fray. And in this case, he wanted to send right from the start, no, I'm going to be right in the fray and I'm going to draw sharp distinctions with Donald Trump, who I'm going to be running against, and I'm going to do it in the sharpest possible terms. So that was an element where you could just go, I'm over here and he's way over there and you should be aware of that. But I still thought it was very significant that at a time when, you know, Ukraine isn't the number one thing on Americans' minds, that's where he went.
Thank you for that setup, Dmitry. I was just going to jump in to say that, you know, Gaza and Israel is, of course, number one on everyone's minds here in DC. And I think Biden really took advantage of the fact that I think this upcoming election will be largely decided on a lot of foreign policy issues hinging on. So he really used the opportunity there to kind of, you know, claw back some support from the base, you know, the Gen Z base and millennial base that I think we've discussed before, to show them that he's got thought leadership and actual leadership in action there. I think one of the things that they announced was this like floating humanitarian aid support for Gaza, which, as we pointed out in Intrigue, means, you know, American footprint in the area expanded to sort of just outside of Gaza. And we don't know what the long-term implications of that will be. But one thing is clear is that obviously the US is going, well, they don't think that the conflict is going to be resolved anytime soon. But I have to say, just as a sort of like a sprinkler of lightness here, the memes that come out of, you know, the State of the Union are probably the best ones. I think like one of the best ones I saw today was one of Kamala Harris and Mike Johnson standing next to each other. The caption was like, "It's giving divorced parents at parent-teacher night." And it's so good. The both of them have their arms crossed and are looking, you know, sternly at the audience. But that's one of the more interesting aspects for me anyway.
Tell me you've seen the Republican response to the State of the Union. It is the weirdest.
I have not, no.
Jump on my Twitter. I reposted like a clip of Senator Katie Britt, who's from Alabama, who gave it. But jump on it. It's a weird performance. Dimitri, you were going to say something?
The most punchy joke I've seen about it, it's a good reminder that a lot of these people in politics are just theater kids who are too homophobic to do theater.
Well, oh, dear.
I don't do domestic US politics, but so I have no comment on, you know, the various things that she said, but just the performance is, I just can't comprehend that they screen tested her and went like, yep, you're ready for the prime time. It's a really remarkable train wreck. But just to wrap up this sort of State of the Union chat, three things struck me about Biden's speech. One is, I agree with you, Helen, that Gaza is kind of a play to the left for him, the kind of the floating pier or however that's going to work. You know, and I think there are tons of questions about how that's going to work. It feels very much an announcement leading the capability, but you know, I'm not a development / military engineer, so who knows if it's possible, like they're saying it's possible. It's not necessarily convincing folks on the left or convincing Gen Z that he's, you know, the right president for them. I think it's just trying to give them enough to not stay home. They're never going to vote. Well, if they're sensible about it, they're never going to vote for Trump, because Trump would be materially worse for their interests. But there is a real risk that if the youth vote doesn't come out in November, that Trump could win in that kind of same way that he won in 2016, which is the sort of apathy of people in the middle, not liking either option, and therefore Trump sucking up all the rabid kind of fans that he has, and Biden not being able to do that. I think these things are kind of just like a, hey, listen, this is really difficult. I hear you. Please don't stay home. And obviously Michigan is the big sort of said bit of that, right? Like that's a swing state. 100,000 uncommitted folks in that primary. He will be hoping that this is kind of him saying here's enough for you to vote in November. The second thing is, isn't it remarkable? I think we mentioned this in Intrigue as well. Isn't it remarkable that Israel's closest ally, America, is actively having to go around the Israeli government to deliver aid to Gazans? Like, we're not talking about a disagreement behind the scenes and them collaborating and cooperating on a solution. This is the US being like, Israel will not listen to us on this. They can't stop us doing this, so we are going to do it. And against, presumably, the Netanyahu government's objections. I find that a remarkable thing, because Israel hasn't got many friends in the world. Certainly none of the kind of stature of America. And I just find it really perplexing that this dynamic is playing out.
Well, and remember, John, I think I'd mentioned to the Intrigue team that I've heard reports that the US thinks that it's lost leverage on Israel and that they just have no leverage whatsoever in terms of being able to implement any changes.
No leverage that they're willing to use. They absolutely have leverage. Could say no more weapons for you, but nothing that they're willing to do, and particularly not in an election year.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I think there's another element to this, and we've talked about this before, I think even on this podcast, which is, so in a hypothetical scenario where the US says no more weapons, that's an easy decision to make comparatively when the weapons are being used to bomb Gaza. But Hezbollah is looking increasingly is flooding increasing with bombs. So in a situation where you've got Hezbollah rockets raining in, is a U.S. president credible in telling Israel, listen, we're going to cut off, we're not even going to sell you weapons if there's a scenario where you're facing external threats? And the problem with weapons is that they're bloody fungible. The exact same bomb that you would use to take out an attacking column of Hezbollah fighters is one that Netanyahu can then drop on a civilian block in Gaza, which just makes this all the more difficult. The one thing I wanted to just, on the last one on Sotu, just to kind of nuance Helen's comment about it all being sort of Gaza-focused, the Gaza-Ukraine contrast is really interesting because on Ukraine, there's a clear policy difference. Trump and the Republicans, or at least a subsection of the Republicans, believe the U.S. should not be funding Ukraine. The Democrats believe that they should, and Joe Biden believes that they should. On Gaza, you have Biden that has a policy that many in his party don't like, and it's not entirely clear what Trump and the Republican policy is at all. It's hard to discern what the policy difference is. There's just a disappointment with how Biden is going about the situation. It's an interesting contrast to me.
Well, yeah, politically, there's no advantage to Trump for saying one way or the other what his policy would be, because then he either opens himself to criticism or he cuts off a line of criticism of the Biden administration. So it's much easier to say, I'd do it better. I'd do it better than what he's doing. Which is, you know, pretty classic politics. I think you see that in the UK at the moment too. Let's leave that there. State of the Unions are always a bit like five people care about them for about 20 minutes and then move on. But yeah.
I mean, all of DC cares about it in the sense that you shut downtown last night and the traffic was terrible. So that's about the amount of care here.
Get out a tiny violin for the swamp class, Helen.
That's the swamp class.
Zelensky makes you late for dinner in Davos. Now that's Biden. Right.
Truly, again, I am the victim, you know.
All right, folks, let's move on to our main topic. I'm excited to discuss this one. I think it's an interesting one. So let me kind of set the scene here. This is probably a recency bias in my mind, but it feels like we are seeing a increase in stories about spies being caught or spies being expelled or spying things happening. I mean, we can go back as far as 2015-16, when Australia alerted the world to Huawei being essentially a systematic spying network in everyone's telecommunications, as that went mainstream and everyone was like, oh my God, are they going to be able to, you know, listen to my phone calls and all that kind of stuff. Industrial espionage has been a big theme in the US for a while. You know, Chinese and Russian spies in universities collaborating with professors to steal technology, weapons technology, chip technology, all this kind of stuff. I think Google an ex-Googler was just arrested, or at least an arrest warrant was issued for stealing AI chip designs. This happened last week, I think, if I'm not wrong. There's been a few other situations. We've obviously got the chap in the remarkable story about the guy who spied for Cuba for 40 years in the US Foreign Service, who rose to the level of ambassador, which, I don't know, having worked in a foreign service, it feels like that didn't get enough coverage. An ambassador level person being a admitted foreign agent, that's kind of movie level stuff, isn't it?
Totally. I mean, I'm sure Netflix has got a deal in the making. You just watch.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think they were paying him, or they were like, someone will actually read your cable? Like that would be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure we'll get onto that, but the I think it was the Googler who got arrested last week, or the arrest warrant. He was selling secrets for $42,000.
Yeah, that's right. And somebody, I think, in our intrigue community was like, if I were to sell people out, I'd get a lot more than $42,000. Yeah, that feels like a low price.
And that's the theme through Le Carre novels, through reality, is the people they turn. I mean, if you go back to like Aldrich Ames and the folks who turned during the Soviet Union, it was kind of like money that is embarrassingly petty. And Dimitri, you joke, but hey, we really value your insights. You're really smart. And like, you know, Natalia here thinks you're quite handsome as well. You know, literally the things that turn people who are able to be turned are less compelling than you would think. But just to finish off this kind of setting up, there's a story that broke this morning or yesterday that there's been Chinese technology in cranes in US ports that have the ability to be turned on as kind of radio frequency things to spy on. Presumably that's kind of getting intelligence on trade data and kind of that kind of stuff. And then the piece de resistance of this when we decided to talk about spying and everything was about 2 weeks ago now, maybe 10 days ago, the Australian head of the domestic spy service in Australia, ASIO, so responsible for kind of catching foreign spies in Australia and maintaining security internally. They don't operate internationally. So MI5, MI6 kind of distinction, CIA, FBI distinction. The head of ASIO came out and gave a fairly remarkable speech, which I want to get into, where he sort of laid out a sort of a state of play in Australia where foreign spies were running rampant. ASIO was ratcheting up their kind of efforts to catch all these spies and had considerable success. One senior Australian politician had been essentially working as an agent of a foreign power, aka China, let's be honest, refused to name that minister. You know, cue speculation of who that person is, and I don't think we can get into that because we don't want to get sued, but it kind of really brought to the front in Australia, like, oh my God, everyone's spying on us and we need to be scared. So that's kind of the scene that we wanted to talk about. I'm going to throw it over to you because I've been talking for 3 minutes now. Helen, take it where you will.
I would like to start with a Google guy. The chatter amongst the Google guy is apparently he's been just selling secrets of where the best snacks are across all the Google offices and like where you can get the most perks. And anyway, so it's all very sort of mundane within Google.
I'd pay for that if I was at Google, to be honest.
Correct, yeah. Where can you get the protein bars? I think, look, with that in Australia, it's not the first time that something like that has been debated in the sort of public discourse, but I'd say it's the first time that the spy chief or the sort of ASIO FBI equivalent domestic security chief has stated something that publicly, right? And I think it sort of sends a very strong signal for folks to be reminded of foreign interference in Australian politics, which perhaps in recent years has subsided because, you know, the Labor Party, who's the current administration, has done a very sort of intentional job of not making that sort of leading with that as a sort of, you know, relationship between Australia and China. So for me, I would love to sort of be back in the halls of the RGKC, which is our, you know, foreign ministry office, to sort of hear about what the chatter is like and who folks think it might be. But I think it paints a really sort of kind of concerning picture about the level of infiltration within the Australian political class. And I mean, let's not forget there's also, I think, an election year coming up. Is it next year or end of this year?
No, never next far year. From an election in Australia, to be honest.
No, that's right. 3-year cycles are very, very short. You're basically campaigning the whole time.
Right.
What do you reckon, Dim?
So this is, I wasn't born in Australia, but I obviously, you know, I'm an Australian citizen. I spent a lot of time there. And one of the things that these revelations made me think about is kind of the Australian mindset and ethos towards this stuff. Because depending on where you worked, you were very aware of Chinese spying being a consistent thing for decades. If you worked in the higher education sector and you were a tutor or a lecturer, because you would have a lot of Chinese students in your class, at some point a professor would tell you, hey, listen, under no circumstances are you to push these students to criticize the CCP because there is a very high likelihood that there will be informers and intelligence people in the room to report on them. And these wouldn't probably be spies directly. These would be informants. And so this is going back. I was getting this lecture in 2010.
Yeah, like not even kind of people on the, and I think this is worth clarifying, not people on the Chinese payroll per se, but Chinese students in Australia or abroad who have had patriotic visits from officials saying, don't forget, even though you're outside China, you are Chinese and your job is to, you know, uphold the values. But just to clarify people, I think it's such a weird thing that a lot of folks who haven't got experience with China don't understand. It's like the Chinese government really tries to deputize citizens abroad as informants, as you say. So it's not like these kids aren't students. They're not spies, but they are students, but they are kind of narcs, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes to the point of it being a very concerted strategy of the CCP to weaponize in some ways, or sort of to use Chinese diaspora to kind of further their reach abroad.
Way.
in a coordinated way. And, you know, I think there's been plenty of kind of books written about this, but it's a very different relationship. You know, the three largest communities, I think the top two, I think, are the Indians and the Chinese diaspora internationally in terms of people who were born in that country and then migrated overseas. I think folks know this, but I'm Chinese diaspora as well. And I think it is a very different relationship to the way that sort of the Chinese government views the Chinese diaspora versus other governments. I think they sort of, you know, within the Chinese language, John, you know this, they sort of see it as the descendants of the dragon, right? The children of the Yellow Sea, right? Or the Yellow Rip. Okay, I'm butchering the Chinese.
I'm not going to go on record correcting a Chinese-born person about Chinese history, to be honest.
Excellent. Well, we can move right along from that.
Branding exercise, 10 out of 10.
I know.
Australia's like, you foreign wankers, and China's like, the descendants of the sea.
Correct.
I cut you off before when you were talking about industries who have long been aware of this dynamic and that it's not a surprise. And sorry about that.
No. I think it's a really good point Helen brings up. And then sort of going beyond that, there was a strong awareness that, for example, the Falun Gong, so China was spying on foreign enclaves of things that are considered to have an impact on its sort of the Free Tibet movement. So it was targeted at them. And then I think if you spoke to Australian industry, they were quite aware of a certain level of not exclusively Chinese, but Chinese corporate espionage, again, going back decades. But at the time, especially if you go back 15 years, it wasn't they're stealing nuclear secrets. It's they're stealing the blueprints of our vacuum cleaner because they want to manufacture it without paying us our pay rates. But so in select circles, it was like, yes, there's infiltration. But then like, I think Australia, because of our cultural hangups, always thought of ourselves as like, surely we're not important enough for anybody to be playing these Le Carre games.
Well, we're not a nuclear power. We don't have a giant military. So there is that sense of like, what do they want from us?
Yeah. And so this feeling of like, we don't have to take security as seriously because let the US be paranoiacs, let them play their things. Setting aside Pine Gap, we can just kind of be relaxed about this stuff. And I think having the ASIO chief come out and go, no, like, we may not take ourselves that seriously, but they take us seriously.
So tell me what either of you, maybe start with you, Dim, what your reactions to his actual speech were. Like, I mean, we don't have to go over what he said, but like just the vibes of a domestic spy chief kind of coming out of the shadows and explaining this stuff to the Australian people. Like, do you think it was a good piece of communication from him?
So my sense, and I think actually a lot of Intrigues reporting supported this, is that if you think about who his audience were, it wasn't necessarily like the average Australian. He was sending a shot across the bow of the thousands of people in Australia with security clearances who are sort of freelancing and taking jobs to be like, remind them that, hey, you know, we take this seriously and there is an agency that is out there to watch who you're getting wire transfers from. And it was also, I think, a very, very deliberate shot across the bow of the Chinese and other intelligence agencies abroad to basically go, we see what you're doing. We have infiltrated you back. We have a huge amount of confidence in our ability to map out what you're doing to us, and we will not stand for it. From that perspective, I think it did those two jobs well. Whether the conversation it kickstarts on Newsnight is valuable in the long run, I don't know.
I couldn't agree with that more, Dim. And I think this sort of falls in line. It's sort of like from the playbook of what other spy agencies in Western countries have done in terms of exposing the kind of underhanded tactics of adversaries. There's nothing sort of that's a better deterrence than to kind of bring things out in from the shadows into the light. And that's kind of the vibe that I got from listening, reading it. It was really, it was really fascinating in terms of the timing, though. I did wonder, like, why now? Do either of you have thoughts about that?
Not really. I suspect it's kind of an attempt to sort of give a state of the, you know, intelligence affairs of the country at a time, you know, not random time, but like, I don't think there was any specific trigger, but I don't know. I haven't had any conversations where they're like, oh, something big went down, so he felt like he had to push it forward, but maybe that was the case. That whole cliche of like the best disinfectant is sunlight and all that kind of stuff. I think that's I think that's right in some ways. I also, and again, wild speculation, which is my speciality on our podcast, it feels like that's also a tactic you use when you're feeling overwhelmed, that the idea of maybe not overwhelmed, but you feel like you've learned enough and there's nothing more you can learn from counter-espionage that they don't know that you're aware of. Like, you know, for example, I mean, very, very basic analogy would be if you've infiltrated a criminal gang as the FBI, you don't pull that informant out and make it public by arresting them until you've got what you need. Or you know, the idea that like they made it public tells me that they are either being overwhelmed by these kinds of things and they have to like put up a defense that is public and can kind of attack all of these things without being specific at once, so that every agent, Chinese agent in Australia is like, is he talking about us? Is he talking about our group? Or they're just like, hey, we have actually rounded them up. We're pretty confident there aren't too many more of these operating. Maybe there are, but we're going to come public now as like a warning going forward. I think it probably hints at one of those things. But, and this is where I'm going to bring in some, not disagreement, because I actually agree with you guys, but just, I continue to just—
Here we go.
I'm hitting an age, Helen, where I am old enough to remember a time where like the environment around this stuff was so different that it reminds me that I'm just shocked we've come this far. So I was a law student in the early 2000s, you know, war and terror, you know, Patriot Act, spying on Americans, waterboarding, all these kinds of controversies that were done by the CIA during that period. And I was studying international law at the time. And there was this guy in the Attorney General, or the Justice Department in America, called John Yoo, who famously wrote all these memos, which, you know, allowed torture and all this kind of stuff. And the legal reaction to this was like, you can't spy on Americans. You have a very privileged— spy agencies have a very privileged, tenuous position in a democratic society because they are empowered to work outside democracy. Citizens in democracies have to trust that these folks aren't abusing the powers that are given to them in the legislature. And in Australia, you know, I don't think we have quite as sorted a history as maybe the US does on this front, but like ASIO and ASIS are not without their controversies. And I rant privately about how I think Australia is we're too kind of acquiescent. We just, you know, say yes sir, no sir, three bags full, and we don't really take our freedoms and our liberties particularly seriously. It is remarkable to me that the head of a spy agency who is enabled to work in the shadows and to spy on Australians can come out publicly and say one of your elected senior officials, ministers, was maybe not a spy per se, but was working in concert with foreign agents, but I'm not going to tell you who it was. And Australians go, oh yes, well, we must take it very seriously. And, you know, if he says that we don't need to know who it is, then we don't need to know who it is. I'm sorry. And I know he uses the example of like, oh, we don't want to burn our sources. We don't want to like— Then don't come out and publicly say it. It either needs to be quiet, or you have a duty. Like, if Australians elected a person who worked for China, that is pieces of information that you work for us and we need to know about it.
Maybe there's more to come. I don't know. Maybe this is a sort of drip feeding of information so people stay tuned and keep watching.
What's talking about in Australia, the conversation of like, how dare you? You work for us. It's either public information or it's not. But it can't be in this place of like, well, it is very much like that idea, you know, that general MacGuffin of like, if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have anything to fear. Democracies have debunked that as a legitimate way to operate a spy agency. It's like, no, you have to operate as transparently as possible. We accept that, you know, if one of these foreign ministers was working at that, well, fair enough, go and investigate them. Don't tell us about it. But you can't come out and tease us and hint that that was the case, but just trust us. You don't need to know who it is. I mean, maybe I'm wrong on this, but it feels like we've got a long way away from the healthy distrust of government agencies that have an inordinate amount of power to spy on us, to a very like, okay, if you think it's best, then that's best, which is worrying to me.
No, I can't find the strength to disagree with you there. And, you know, when you're spouting libertarian ideas, you know how much it hurts me not to be able to be like—
I don't think this is libertarian so much.
It's a 22-point intervention about why you're wrong. But no, I think that specific element of it, coming out and saying there is kind of a minister, a former minister who is compromised, and I can't tell you who it is, that, you know, I don't want to overuse the word, there's something McCarthyist in it of being like, we've been infiltrated at the highest levels. I can't 100%. Name names, but you should absolutely turn to your left and right. And like one of those people is a spy. And if none of them is a spy, it's you. To kind of steel man it, he was trying to say, to give you a sense of how serious this is, how deep the rabbit hole goes. They have even compromised ministers. But I'm almost like, you're the head of a spy agency. If you can't convince people that spying is bad without this kind of one person gathered here for dinner tonight is a murderer, like, and none of you shall leave. Like, if you can't do it without those kind of theatrics, what are you doing? And then another part of me is just like, so, okay, you can't say it in a speech, but like, presumably you've told the prime minister. And it's like, you either have enough to arrest this person and charge them and indict them with crimes, or you don't. And like, does this person still have a security clause? Like, it raises
I don't think
so
that's
many
the,
questions.
It raises a lot of questions. I totally agree. But I don't think this is the end of it, right? I think this is sort of just like the first chapter of things that are about to unveil. I think like they might be making arrests later on this year, or there might be more revelations to come. I think this is just sort of seeding it.
Potentially, go ahead, Helen. And none of this is to me to say like these folks are stupid and aren't thinking this stuff through. Like, obviously, you know, the folks who work in ASIO and at that level too will have wargamed all of this stuff and made a judgment call that this is the kind of right way to go, and you know, weighed up all the equities and said on balance, you know, this is the way. So it's not me kind of saying that they don't know what they're doing. What I'm disagreeing with, I'm actually almost disagreeing with the Australian public / media response to being so okay with this. I mean, not to kind of speculate too much, but like, we have a Labor government. Labor has been traditionally closer to the Chinese Communist Party. I'm not going to say they're close, but like, they're more sympathetic to the Chinese Communist Party than I would say the Liberals have been. I think that's probably a fair statement. You're right that the head of ASIO would have had to inform the prime minister, who is a Labor prime minister. Is there a potential like, oh, it was a former minister, this doesn't look good politically, do you mind not mentioning who it is? Now, I'm not saying that's why the decision was made, but like, the fact that he hasn't made it opens questions to like, is this a political cover-up, or is this genuinely like, I can't reveal my sources? And that in therein is the problem. I'm not saying that that's what's happened, but the fact that it's open to interpretation is why I'm just kind of like, I just can't endorse an approach that goes like this. And Dimitri, to your point, I think there was a way to give this speech, to be transparent, to be careful about alerting Australians to the fact that this stuff is prevalent, and maybe you didn't realize this, but you need to be, and it's serious, without breadcrumbing it like that, in a way that I think is problematic. But I 2024, I think people are getting, you know, we see this online, we see it with TikTok, we see it with people are just a lot more sanguine and acquiescent about their personal freedoms and privacy than they were 20 years ago. Maybe the social contract has changed with spy agencies. Maybe people are more comfortable with these folks working in the shadows and not telling us what they're doing and not being transparent and just trusting them. Because it's like, what's your choice? Trust ASIO or trust China? Choose ASIO every day. I don't know. What I'm ranting about is probably an interesting segue into the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is kind of, we're seeing more of this transparency at the top of spy agencies around the world. You know, I'm minded to think of Bill Burns at the CIA kind of opening up the CIA's books. I mean, that's dramatic. He kind of declassified a few bits of information ahead of Russia's invasion of Ukraine to preempt what he knew, what the CIA knew would be Russian disinformation following the invasion, as kind of a pre-bunking. We've referred to that term in Intrigue, and I'm going to go ahead and say we coined it, even though I'm sure we probably didn't, but we coined the phrase pre-bunking. The idea of getting in front of this stuff seems like that's what the ASIO speech was about, kind of pre-bunking stuff maybe, or at least being more transparent. Why do you think spy agencies are kind of coming out into the light and using their power of information in this way when they have such a history of being like incredibly clandestine.
I think the nature of kind of information sharing has changed and access to information has changed, right? So I think these days it's much easier to access information for the common folk, normies like us. But I think to answer your question, John, it's a tactic, right? It's a tactic with the strategy of kind of deterring what they think is going to happen. If there's any room for change, putting off some other decisions by the adversary that could be even more detrimental. But that's sort of the simple take on all this. I'm sure Dimitri is about to dunk on me and provide a more sophisticated response.
I mean, I don't know that I can do either. One thing that I was thinking about as you were saying that is perhaps the threat perception of spy agencies has changed in that in the Cold War, yes, there was kind of a narrative battle, but the primary battle was like, do you know where our missiles are? Have you anticipated our next strategic move on the chessboard? You know, technology that's on. There's obviously still, that's all still going on. It's important to know where troops are moving and people are trying to steal chip technology. But the biggest danger by far is the narrative shaping. That is, the influence ops are where clearly the spy agencies are perceiving a lot of threat, and that is linked back to, I think, some of these strategic threats. If half your country is convinced that a foreign adversary is actually a good guy, that makes it a lot easier for you to recruit an Air Force E2 for just $42,000 to slip you some secrets. Or the one we haven't talked about, which I can't believe I haven't talked about, is the colonel who was arrested, who was like honey trapped on like Slavic dating site
Why don't you give us the 60-second background on that?
I'm
dying. This one's pretty
already
funny. Seriously funny.
So Colonel was effectively met someone on a dating site for meeting foreigners. My understanding is he believed she was Ukrainian, and she just kind of talked him into handing over, like in the least transparent way possible. The only person on earth who was a worse actor delivered the Republican response to the State of the Union. The second worst actor is this person. Because she was like, oh, honey, you know so many things. Is US planning a surprise for Russia tomorrow? And he'd be like, yes, my dear, I've just come from a classified briefing and here it is. It's just, I mean, I don't know. Is this like, is this what happens in a country with like a 2% unemployment rate? The military is just no longer able to competitively hire people who aren't incredibly gullible? I don't know.
I've got a very, very quick transcript. I'll read a couple of things here. Beloved Dave, do NATO and Biden have a secret plan to help us? On or about March 23, Dave, it's great that you get information about specified country one first. I hope you'll tell me straight away. You are my secret agent with love. I mean, I'm not convinced this isn't like an elaborate kind of, you know, James Franco kind of movie vehicle where they've planted this story into real life, because that's absurd. That's absurd that a colonel who will have been briefed at every promotion level about foreign honeypots or foreign agents is, I mean, he must have known. It's as simple as that.
This reads like the script you would get in a mandatory e-learning for staff with the lowest possible clearance on what a honey trap sounds like. Or like this, you know, when they like do the training exercise and they're like, we're going to pull two people up and, you know, Dimitri, you're going to play the honey pot, read this script before we descended into masterpiece theater, is the fact that increasingly what they are seeing is the prize is shaping narratives, and shaping narratives is about a combination of credibility and being first out the gate. You've got to set the story.
That last bit being particularly important in a world where information travels in, you know, real time, like speed of light. You can't, you simply cannot, and proliferates, you know, through bot farms and troll farms. You cannot simply respond and do this, you know, ludicrous thing that media companies think works, which is like fact-checking real-time information. So what's the only way to get around that? Well, it's to short-circuit that and get in front of it and say, hey, here's what they're going to say. And then they come out and say it, and you've got credibility because you knew what they were going to say. So yeah, you're absolutely right, Dimitri. Credibility and preempting is what the information battle is, right?
Yeah. Looking at like specifically the Russia-Ukraine thing when it comes to the US politics, in terms of influence ops or spy ops, Russia can do a lot more benefit for its cause if it convinces the US that it shouldn't supply aid to Ukraine than it can by stealing any individual piece of technology or battle plans or anything like that. So that's where the ball game is now.
Yeah, and I think Putin is a master at understanding that, you know, democracy is both a strength and a weakness, in the sense that it's a strength because it's resilient and you can take blows and you can ditch unpopular governments without ditching the government. But it's a weakness too, because you can weaponize domestic politics of another country in a way that was absolutely impossible, you know, even as recently as 20 years ago. So I think you're absolutely right. Can I ask you another question? We're talking about China and Russia largely because they are, you know, let's not pretend that they're not the key actors here doing this on a scale that is, you know, that matters. But does it matter that, like, of course, that people have been spying on each other left, right, and center? It's not insane to think Russia wants to influence America. It's not insane to think China wants to, like, does this stuff matter, or is this all just kind of like very interesting scuttlebutt? You know, everyone's always done it and this is just the latest iteration. Why should we care about this?
I don't think folks kind of care about the spying as much as a broader, like, corporate surveillance culture, right, that we've had with big tech in the last sort of 10 to 20 years. If you're speaking to a sort of average person who's not really involved in the national security or sort of government affiliated space, I don't think the average person cares as much about this sort of, you know, spy on spy sort of espionage stuff as much as they care about private sector big tech companies collecting their privacy data, right? Or like,
should they care?
Well, of course they should care, but I think that's because we've sort of been able to operate and sort of worked in that space and understand the broader implications of it. And this again goes back to things that we've discussed on this poddy as well about the importance of this is not communicated effectively enough by folks who are in charge, right? And I think there's not really an effective political messaging to folks about why they should care more about this.
Dim, why don't you try and communicate that for us now? Like, why should the average Joe Blow in Melbourne or Kansas, why should they care about these influence efforts, spying, Chinese communications gear found in cranes in US ports? Why care, apart from the fact that it might make Netflix one day?
My best pitch is the reason that governments do this is because they anticipate a moment when their interests will be unaligned with, for example, Australia's. There will be something that the Chinese government wants that the Australian government feels is antithetical to Australian interests. The reason that this spying is happening is to put China or Russia or whoever in a stronger position for that moment to be able to affect change. Now, from a normal person's perspective, that can have two effects. First of all, a lot of what spying is about gathering leverage. And that leverage is at the level of nation states and sort of interests, but it's also at the level of people. It is about being able to compromise individuals. And you may not be in a position where a foreign government is interested in you today, but you and your loved ones may be in that position a week from now. And intelligence agencies are actively trying to gather as much dirt and leverage on our citizens as they can against that rainy day. And especially when it comes to China, which massively resources these intelligence operations, they are casting a wide net, and you would be surprised who makes it inside that net. So that's on a personal level. But on a broader level, if a foreign government were trying to hurt our citizens in some other way, we would take umbrage to it. If someone were trying to rip our citizens off, if someone were trying to sell us defective products, if someone were trying to cheat us out of something, they are doing something that is against our laws, in breach of our privacy, and in breach of the core role of government, which is protecting our national interest. And, you know, you don't have to have that occupy your thoughts each and every waking moment. It can be a fairly tertiary concern, but it should be a concern.
I agree with all of that. I think we talked about this on the NATO episode about why America should fund NATO or shouldn't fund NATO. And me always just harping on about the fact that I think when you zoom out on all of these questions, and particularly this question about foreign spying and why we should be trying to stop it and why it matters to, you know, Joe Blow, it all comes back to the fact that I think our governments and our modern cadre of politicians do an absolutely appalling job of defining the national interest. You just said it there. It's like, oh, well, we want to stop spies because they'll do things that are against our national interest. All of stopping spying is a function of what is your national interest. And that the national interest is a function of explaining what a country is in the world, what it believes about the world, and what it needs to kind of exist in the world in that way. So using the Australian context of that, you know, to be anti-China spying, you kind of need to believe that China is trying to overthrow Australian democracy, and I believe in democracy, or China will invade Taiwan, and it is in the Australian interest to defend Taiwan. Because if you don't believe in those core things, or if you haven't had what the Australian interest is communicated to you clearly in a way that you can understand, surely then you care less about protecting it, which means you care less about preventing people from undermining it. And to me, it's not particularly clear what the Australian national interest is beyond protecting what we have. And maybe that's enough. Maybe you say to China, Russia, whatever, wants to undermine the way you live. And I think that's a very effective political argument. But it strikes me that all of this stuff is downstream of all of us, Americans, Brits, particularly Brits potentially, needing a far clearer political explanation from our leaders about what we are in the world, what we stand for, what we're willing to protect, and how we want to exist, in my view.
John, it sounds like you need to get into politics. I mean, like, that's probably the most compelling argument I've heard.
Out of the three of us, Helen, I think I would be... This is a bit of an inside to baseball, but there's an a Queensland Rugby League legend called Mal Meninga, who famously had about a 12-second... political career in Australia. He an absolute legend and apparently a very nice guy, but not the most eloquent. In his first ever press conference announcing he was running for parliament, he sat down and said, well, I'm running for parliament because, oh, you know what? I can't do this. I resign. And that was the length of his political career. And I think I might give his longevity or lack of it a run for his money if I ever ran for politics.
I look forward to the day.
But I wanted to sort of come back on your point, John, of sort of the scale of the threat. Because you were saying, you know, you have to believe they want to overthrow Australian democracy, or you have to believe they want to invade Taiwan. And I don't actually think you need to go anywhere near that far to take this seriously. To go back to some of the examples from 10 years ago I was talking about, the Chinese government wants to control what students at an Australian university are able to say out loud.
But they're not Australians. They're here. Who cares? I'm playing devil's advocate here, but like, yeah, you know, it's not. If they came into my classroom and told my kids what to say, well, that becomes a national interest I can really understand. But you know, the Chinese government restrained it to Chinese students. So like, well, whatever. What's my dog in that fight? Come over here, pay your money. Fine.
Kind of. Except now, I mean, I don't want to go too deep into this, but now you've got effectively lecturers and teaching assistants or tutors self-censoring and guiding their class around the sensitivities of a foreign government, which has a lot of sensitivities. I mean, look, we can go back and forth on that example. Or the Falun Gong. Some of those guys were Australian citizens. No, they're no longer Chinese nationals. They are Australian citizens in Australia who are part of a social movement that is fully legal in Australia and that the Chinese government is actively... or was actively messing with. Now, this, you know, this doesn't rise to the level of tanks on the Parliament House lawn, and it's not even tanks on the beaches of Taiwan. But this is the sort of thing that I think Australians, if it was put to them like that, would find objectionable, because we don't believe in much, but we believe in being left alone and we push back on bullies.
No, look, I mean, I obviously agree with you. I think I'm pretty much on record as being relative.
In furious agreement, as always.
Well, I am, yeah, and I am a relative hawk against China. But I think my point, and I think the education example is a compelling one when you start thinking about self-censorship. Mm. I think my position has always been, you know, China also wants leverage over the Australian political system so that in a crisis, and Taiwan's the one that comes to mind just because it's, you know, easy and in the mainstream, they hope that they can leverage their influence in Australia to keep us either out of that fight or to, you know, delay our entry into that fight. I mean, that's what it is, right? It's like it's on these big ticket items, they want to be able to influence Australian decision making, just like Russia would say that their goal vis-a-vis Ukraine and America is to insert enough uncertainty into the into Congress that what we've seen happens. They don't they stop sending missiles to Ukraine, and that now is seems to be translating to some moderate wins on the battlefield for Russia, or at least that's the narrative that the media will tell you. So that's the goal. And I think, again, I think all of that is downstream from a clear, concise, unambiguous enunciation to citizens of why Taiwan matters, why Ukraine matters, why these big issues that would be broadly defined by all our foreign services as in the national interest, why that matters to me as I go to work and try to feed my kids and am saving up for a holiday. Why should I care about that? And I think you should. And I think all of, I'm in furious agreement, but it just strikes me that too much of our modern political discourse around geopolitics and foreign policy and national interest is ambiguous and just trust us because we're smarter than you and national interest is a word that you kind of get overwhelmed by. So just trust us. And that gives rise to folks like Trump and other populists who say, you're not an idiot for not understanding this. They're all criminals, which is also bullshit. So I don't know. I just feel like all of this stuff is downstream from much more honest, clear political debate. And to tie that back to the ASIO chap coming out and saying all of that stuff, if transparency is the goal, which, you know, it clearly is and you know, fair enough, I wonder if it harms more than it helps when you come out and kind of create more ambiguity by, Dimitri, you raising that very kind of evocative specter of everyone looking to their left and right and wondering if you're the one who works for China. I wonder if that's more ambiguous than sort of saying, hey, we know China's operating on our shores, trying to influence our political system. We're working to stop it. You know, everyone go about your business. Anyway, just thoughts.
It needs to be converted into reality TV. If there's ways that we can work it into the sort of Married at First Sight or something, you know, on primetime TV that can speak to folks, then great. But I really do think
it would be clearly in the national interest, Helen.
Okay, correct. I mean, like, honestly, I don't think people really, you know, would, not everyone, obviously, I'm not dumbing people down, but I really do think that the political messages are not cutting across.
Yeah, it's not about people being dumb. It's about not having the bandwidth to kind of follow this stuff like we follow it. Like,
totally.
It's like in the same way that we don't follow the best methods of like constructing a house or marketing to, you know, marketing skincare because it's not our job. It's not these people's job to be deeply poring over think tank work on what the national interest is. It should be communicated very simply to them as citizens.
I wonder if to go back to your like initial question of why did he drop this like specter of a compromised minister without being willing to name them. I wonder if it was firstly because he knew the speech would make a splash. And so now we're doing this podcast, now it's front page news. Whereas if it had contained fewer revelations, it wouldn't have. And secondly, because to go back to the questions you were pushing me on, if I wanted to explain the seriousness of foreign assets, being able to go, do you want the confidence of knowing that ministers are making decisions based on their perception of how to govern and not because they're receiving money from abroad or because they've been compromised and are thus susceptible to blackmail from abroad? Don't you want that confidence? That is a 30-second way of telling that story that it took me like 3 minutes of attempted grand eloquence to not really answer.
Yeah. No, I think it's a fair point. And I think probably need to wrap up here. I don't doubt that these folks thought that through clearly. Mm-hmm. These are not, again, I want to stress that my criticisms of this stuff is not because I think people aren't doing a good faith effort at doing their best jobs. I just really wonder if the outcome is not the opposite. If you say our minister is working for China, you cast suspicion on all ministers. And also you are openly not showing that there's too many repercussions for someone who did do it. You know, you're not sort of announcing it and then clapping him in irons, or at least not yet. So anyway, let's leave it there. I think it's a really interesting conversation. And you know what? This is my cards on the table. I'm glad I live in a country and I'm from a country where I can have that conversation without fear of being followed up by, well, you know, famous last words until I get knocked on the door by the FBI. But
yeah, John's disappeared
At date of recording, I've not been investigated for treacherous behavior, but we'll see. Before we wrap up here, we do our cocktail chats, something that sends us off into the weekend to get through the, you know, the cocktail parties that I know we're all attending, you know, every night. Why don't we start with you, Helen? What's kind of interesting and on your mind?
Well, I'm going to a fundraiser this weekend. That'll be fun. I don't know if there's going to be a cocktail circuit per se. But look, today is International Women's Day. And I know before you, both of you kind of, okay, very good responses, good nods, enthusiastic nods.
Who do you think we are?
No comment. I know you are both allies, longtime allies and big feminists, but I just want to point out that it's International Women's Day today, and that's sort of my cocktail chatter going into the weekend. But one of the tweets that I've seen, you know, I've got a lot of views about International Women's Day, which is that I think it just should be, you know, the norm rather than a sort of exception to the way that we look at how women's rights and systemic biases towards women sort of, you know, operating in our world. But one of the best tweets I saw today was the following. It says, behind every International Women's Day campaign, tweet, video, award, panel, and I'll add to that cupcakes, lots of women who are making it all happen. But I propose next year we just take the day off. And you know what? I could not agree more. So that's going to be my sort of campaign heading into International Women's Day next year. And you guys, as allies, can take the day off with me. How about that? that's my spiel.
I completely agree with you, Helen. I mean, we used to do International Women's Day in Shanghai, and my feeling was always like, you know, great events and very interesting, but like, how do you make it not just one afternoon, you know?
100%.
Around.
Yeah, and it's always, you know, the female staff who are, you know, cleaning up the cupcakes after they've been presented cupcakes. So the irony there sits.
Not to digress too much, I had an interesting conversation this week with, like, it would be very interesting to just kind of like have to give younger women opportunities to speak at those things rather than kind of getting, you know, established women who presumably are asked to speak on panels all the time. Like, what is getting a 26-year-old woman being like, hey, this is your first chance to kind of, you know, do what you're going to have to do later in your career in a friendly audience and about a topic that is of your choice, like up you get and have a speak. Those kinds of things I thought were always more interesting than sort of the banal cupcakes that were pink because women apparently, you know.
So offensive. Pink.
Anyway,
yeah,
I don't want to go.
I do love pink, and I do love cupcakes. Just for the record, though, I will never turn away cupcakes.
Unrelated, Helen. Unrelated.
Yeah, unrelated.
All right, my quick chat is: I like to kind of do random ones here. I came across a series of photos in the Atlantic magazine that were taken 100 years ago, 1924. It's kind of odd that we're well into 100 years from like proper photography, not like the old stuff from the Wild West, like real photography with good resolution and all that kind of stuff. So they've published a bunch of these photos of what the world looked like in 1924. Really cool, like really just interesting to see. Two things strike me. One,
were you in those photos?
How dare you? Although that's, you know, it is odd that like I was born in the 80s and that does feel like just a long time ago. As were you, by the way, both of you. Two things strike me. One, everyone was genuinely so much better dressed. From work people wearing like slacks and well-fitted shirts that were designed for work to, you know, women standing for photographs in like furs and hats. I'm sure it wasn't glamorous because people were dying of all kinds of things that now we don't die of, but
dysentery, just, you know.
Aesthetically, it looks much nicer than today. And of course, these photos are taken of probably rich people and all that kind of stuff. I'm aware of that, but that was one thing that struck me. And then the second thing was that everyone posed for photos without smiling, and it looks way better. There's no
you
fake
still do
posing.
That.
I still do it. I just think candid photos, if you're laughing, it's a great photo. If you're posed, don't smile. It's weird. It doesn't look natural.
John has a grimace. That's his pose.
Yeah, I do. And I'm glad to be justified by the fact that in 1924 they'd figured it out and we've gone backwards since then. So that was what I'll put the link there because the photos notwithstanding
Please
my
do.
Gripes and my old man, you know, my old man observations, they're cool photos. Dimitri.
I think it's great that on International Women's Day you harken back to a time before they had the vote. It's
oh my God. You don't do me like that. Don't do me like that.
You guys can't.
It's great.
In your world, Dimitri, no one could talk about anything before about, you know, what, the mid 70s when, well, you still can't talk about anything because arguably, you know, 70 cents on the dollar. Don't talk about anything because everything's awful. Get out here.
You guys can't see, but John is slowly like morphing that into one of those Greek statue Twitter accounts.
Well, I just put a cancel sign around my neck now and get done with it. Have a struggle session with a dunce hat on.
Just a face tattoo, yeah. Thanks.
The thing that caught my eye as Cocktail Chat Banter is that Rupert Murdoch is getting married at the age of 92 for the fourth time He has just announced his engagement. And, you know, as an older Australian in media myself, it just gives me hope.
I mean, he's lapped you a few times now, hasn't he, surely?
I like to think we've both done roughly equivalent amounts of damage to democracy.
Correct.
So, yeah.
57-year-old retired molecular biologist.
Introduced by his former wife, Wendy Deng, right? At one of her events, apparently. I read up on all the Rupert tea here, but that's how they met initially. So interesting, very interesting.
Hey, friends of friends, it's dying out with online dating, so it's good to see him keeping it alive.
Well, Dimitri, Murdoch is an inspiration for you, and I want that on the record. Don't come at me, I'll come back at you. All right.
I think with that.
Where we'll leave it. We've run a bit long again, but I think it was a really interesting conversation to be able to kind of talk through those elements of what folks do in the shadows. We will be back next week. I think we're going to bring you, all being well, a podcast episode on China's two sessions, the legislative meetings going on in Beijing as we talk. We'll try and decode those a little bit and sort of talk about the main things that come out of that. But until then, thank you as always for listening. Dimitri, thank you for being a charming participant as always.
Thanks
and
so much.
Helen, thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Dean. That was great.
This episode was edited and mixed by Sarah Baczynski of Polarity Audio Works.